What's up, math freaks, sharpness geeks, and purveyors of stabby goodness? Welcome to the Knife Freak Show. My name is Jonathan McNeese, joined by my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright.
Episode 30!
Woo! All right, we made it. We're still doing it.
Yeah, still here. Don't know how we've... Yeah, it doesn't seem like we've been doing it for 30 episodes, but then again, yeah. Keep doing it. Eventually the numbers stack up.
It's the same way the years start to stack up when you're, you know, doing anything. But like in our case, you know, being knife makers, like it just, you turn around and before you know it, you've been doing it a while. So,
yeah. I very much feel like that. Don't know how I've been doing this for 5 years. I feel like I've barely been in it a year.
Yeah. But. Tell me about it. Like it really hit me this year at Blade Show. Like, I mean, I knew I stop every now and then and like do the math or whatever of how long I've been doing it. But like, I was in a conversation with somebody at Blade Show this year, you know, in Atlanta, and it was, for whatever reason, I was trying to figure out how many years it had been since I started doing it, and came up with, I'm pretty sure, 17 years. And I was like, oh my God, that's 17 years of doing Blade Show. Like, that's crazy. So doesn't seem like it, but yeah, 30 episodes on here is, that's pretty cool. And I feel like we've got some great listeners. We keep getting great comments, and we're trying to kind of pick up on the cues of the, you know, the content that we're doing that you guys seem to comment more on and all that. We're trying to follow the cues and maybe do more of that kind of stuff. So on that note, it's very important, guys, so we can make the show as much of something you want to listen to as possible. It's important that you give us feedback, good, bad, or ugly. Like, if it was a horrible episode and all we did was run our mouths and act stupid, then tell us, it's fine. I'm used to it. but yeah, we appreciate you guys listening, and we appreciate the feedback, because like I said, it lets us know kind of what direction to head with stuff when we see what's working or what maybe isn't working. So
yeah, and y'all crushed it this past week. We got a ton of comments, and y'all seem to enjoy the knife stories and last week's conversation a lot. So we appreciate y'all's feedback on that.
Yeah, for sure.
With episode 30 and, you know, the celebration of episode 30 or whatever. I'm 30. The podcast is 30. That's great.
There you go. Dirty 30.
Yeah, that works out perfectly. We are going to be unveiling a new logo. For this week. I mean, by the time y'all listen to it, presumably it'll already be on the YouTube channel, on the Spotify. I think I already put it up on the Apple, because I was just trying to check and see if it would work with the Apple formatting, and it's already up there. But yeah, so we have a new logo drawn by an actual artist instead of a robot. So yeah.
Yeah. And it's very excited cool and that. Much appreciated to the artist. So that was,
yeah, and it was
very cool.
Mason Primo is the guy's name, by the way, for anybody out there wondering. For shout out for him.
We greatly appreciate it.
Yeah.
I think it probably fits the theme that we want for the show a little bit more, like kind of personalizes it a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was just, when we started, you know, we were just kind of flying by the seat of our pants and just tried to get a logo. We needed an image.
Yeah, we got to have something to put up there on the screen, so let's get something. So
yeah, but I'm very excited to move away from. I'm not a huge fan of AI and using AI, especially in the form of art, because I don't really know if AI can do art in the technical sense. So having an actual artist's drawing of an idea that we had is very exciting for me.
Yep, much better, much better.
Yeah. All right. How was your week in the shop?
This week was challenging. We did good. We stayed in pretty good shape. We're more or less staying on schedule. We hit our goal for the week again, which was, I know I'm kind of saying it every week, but got to brag on my guys. We hit our goal number for 4 weeks in a row, which is like, if you guys saw the internals, you would know that like for the entire time that we've been doing this, that's been a struggle. Like, even when our goal was much lower than what it is now, it's been a struggle. So that's a huge accomplishment to be able to go a full month of hitting our goal every week. So yeah, very happy. We just had just normal stupid crap that happens. You know, a few parts came off the machine with little discrepancies or whatever that, you know, from a tool being worn or this or that that we didn't catch and having to work through that and cull a few parts and stuff like that. So it, you know, that always kind of slows us down, but we still made it. So how was your week?
Pretty good on, I guess on the, it was, you know, also not without challenges. Update for the, on last episode, I talked about having to, make a new blade for that S90V blade that I had messed up. I ended up actually being able to save it because I had to wait a few days before my S90V got here. And so I was like, well, let's see if I can do something to save it. And I ended up basically just hand lapping the blade and getting it all down where it was flat back towards the pivot and all that and getting everything where it, you know, worked again. And, you know, ended up having to change the thickness on the back spacer and stuff like that to go along with that. But, you know, yeah, I was actually able to save that blade in the end after a lot of hand sanding.
Good. That's good.
Yeah. Hand sanding S90V is not the most fun activity, in case anybody was wondering.
Yeah. But, no, yeah, I imagine that was not pleasant.
No, but, you know, I guess since I did it, I would prefer to do that than restart the blade entirely and have to do that whole process again and just throw it away. And, you know, it's still, you know, 100% functional factory spec or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking as you were describing that's kind of one of the differences between, you know, doing custom stuff and production stuff, because I mean there's certain stuff, I mean there's always can be little small differences from one knife to the next, even in what we're doing, but you know, when it comes to something like the blade thickness, like we don't have a lot of leeway because we're using a standard size set of standoffs, you know, and so
and pivot, most of it is top end and
Right. We need it to, we need everything to match up. Like, and we don't, and then since we sell like replacement hardware and stuff, we can't just have like all these random different sizes out there. But like what you do and when I was doing it as a custom maker, I never actually had, you know, I made different models out of different blade thicknesses and everything else like all the time. Like, you know what I mean? There wasn't necessarily, I wasn't one of these guys that had like a set, you know, all right, this blade has got to be finished out at, you know, 150,000ths, like period. Every one I make is going to be like that. You know, one might be 140,000ths, one might be 155,000ths. You know, it kind of just depended on, sometimes I wanted them to be a little thicker. I was in the mood to build something a little beefier. Sometimes I was in the mood to build something a little slicier or whatever. So, and sometimes it got dictated by a mistake, just like you said. So like, hey, if you can take the blade down a few thousandths and then just make your back spacer or whatever to fit it, then there you go. Like no harm, no foul. Nobody ever knows that it wasn't meant to be that size in the first place. So,
yeah. And I mean, I think I took it down from like 127 or 128 to really close to 120 or 121, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
So I mean, still less it was than a good 10, bit of hand sanding, but yeah. But like back at the pivot was where it was like 120 or 121. And then, so I had to get all the flats all the way down the blade to get back to that. And so, but yeah, that is definitely one of those advantages, that flexibility to have, you know, because I mean, also different steel is supplied in different thicknesses at times. And even to a certain extent, like, you know, some CPM steels have a thicker, like, layer on the outside of carbon buildup or mill scale.
Yeah, mill
basically
scale.
What some of them have real thick layers. Some of them have real thin layers. And so if you buy, you know, eighth inch of CPM 154 versus eighth inch of S90V, they could, you know, they could be supplied to you in a different thickness than even though they're both marked as eighth inch that, you know, so there's a little bit of wiggle room there, and I definitely take advantage of that. And I guess, you know, since learning from you, that's one of the things that, you know, I definitely take advantage of.
Yeah, that's, I mean,
also,
you know, it would be different if you had whatever, like if the customer was expecting like this blade is going, or if you were doing it like a
nothing. Go ahead with your point.
Oh, okay. So if you were like, if the customer, like maybe it was a commissioned knife or whatever, and the customer, you know, specifically wanted a certain blade thickness, you know, and it was going to change more than a couple of thou, then that might be one thing. But when you're basically building something that you're just going to put up for sale, you know, you're just building it basically maker's choice, then I don't see anything wrong with doing, you know, different thicknesses slightly, whatever. And again, like, honestly, 10 thou is, most people aren't going to notice it anyway, unless you hold it up side by side with some, another one. And like, it's not, you know, it's not that much. Yeah. So,
I completely forgot what I was about to say. No, I didn't. But yeah, like, I don't think I would ever take on a commission saying like, okay, this is going to be a 0.125, you know, this blade is going to be 0.125, and you know, that's right. The end of it. The only thing, the only reason I would need to go to that sort of system is, like you said, if I were to sort of standardize a lot more of the parts and the interchangeables and stuff like that, like standoffs and stuff that have a set thickness versus a backspacer that I make, so I can kind of change it how I want.
That's right. That's right. So,
well, cool. And I was going to ask you, you came out with a new finish this week.
Oh yeah.
How'd that go?
I completely forgot about that. Yeah. So, as it may seem like that should be a simple thing to just do, like a regular bright stonewash finish or whatever. And it is, but it isn't. So the big thing that's held us up this whole time about being able to do that finish, well, was two things. One was being able to get the, flats of the blade clean enough. And for a long time, until we bought our own, surface grinder, and we were having blades at one point, we were having blades double disc for us, and the surface of them was not coming out clean enough that we could just tumble them without and them look good. So we would have to do a bunch of hand work to clean them up. And then same thing with the bevels, like the bevels weren't coming out clean enough to be able to do just a straight tumbled finish. And I should probably back up a little bit. The reason that you can't do that, guys, a lot of people, even a lot of knife makers, especially that haven't, you know, played around with it enough, have the misconception that if you've got like scratches and stuff, that you can throw it in the tumbler and it's going to like tumble away those scratches. Now, that actually is true to a certain level, like, but you've got to have if you have scratches that are, say, in my experience with the tumbling stuff that we use, you've got to be up to about a 220 grit at least finish, or else it's not really going to tumble out. So if you get a deeper scratch in there, so say you ground that blade with a 120 and then you stepped up to a 220 to finish it, but you didn't quite get all the 120 scratches out of there, those blades may look nice and clean and completely even, you know, with the off the machine or off the grinder or whatever, like that. But if you throw them in the tumbler, those deeper scratches are going to show through like instantly. Like, well, actually, the longer you tumble it, the more they show. You can't just like tumble them away. So we had to be able to get the right kind of finishes on the flats and on the bevels to be able to do that without having to do a bunch of hand polishing and stuff to get them to that point. So which just wasn't really viable for, you know, trying to put knives out at the price point we're trying to put them out at.
Yeah.
So we've had the flats coming off the surface grinder clean enough for a little while now that it would probably have been okay, but we weren't getting the grinds clean enough. Even when we switched over to this new grinding method that we're doing in-house, it's taken us some time to, first we were just worried about being able to get grinds that are symmetrical, you know, that look right, take the edge down to where we want it, and that are symmetrical and repeatable and all that. And then we started playing with the finishes, and my guy that's doing most of that, he's kept on tweaking the speeds and feeds and stuff until we've got them pretty dang clean now. So, and we still, even with that, we're still having to kind of work around it a little bit, because they still aren't clean enough that you can just straight throw them in the tumbler. So we're having to be very cautious about how long we tumble them. So like on the satin stone wash, we're before we grind the bevels, the blank gets put in the tumbler and the flats get tumbled for at least an hour, or an hour to a couple hours, to put the stone wash finish on them, because they need a little bit more time to look good after coming off the surface grinder. And then we put them on the machine, we grind the bevels, and then we take them off of there and put them back in the tumbler for a very short tumble. And it puts so the tumble on the bevels is actually kind of a very light or loose tumble. So it's not like the scratches are kind of a little farther apart, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because the longer you keep it in there, obviously the more scratches and stuff you get. So you have like just the whole thing is just super, you know, just a bunch of little micro scratches all over it. And the way we're doing it, I actually really like it. It's almost like a cross between like a machine satin and a tumble. So it's like a machine satin that's just been very lightly tumbled on the bevels. So anyway, but trying to get the finishes the way we needed them on the blade off of the machines that we use has been the biggest challenge. It hadn't been just a matter of like, you know, oh, just throw them in the tumbler and do a new finish. Like we hadn't been just cause we didn't want to, we've been trying really hard to get everything to look good enough that we could do that finish. So,
yeah, I know you've wanted to for a long time,
mm-hmm.
get back to that finish sort of, cause we were able to do it in the early times because
we weren't doing it.
Yeah. Cause we weren't doing it per se.
Cause we were using the OEM shop that was doing it. So the shop we were using up in Michigan was doing that for us. And so, yeah, we didn't have the machinery and the capability to do that then. So, and we've finally gotten to that point now. So yeah, very pleased with that.
Yeah. Good. I mean, I do sort of a similar finish on some of my knives, and another thing to consider when you're thinking about stuff like that, when thinking about custom and production, is like my tumbler is about, you know, this big, and Jonathan's tumbler, I could basically get inside of it. So, it wouldn't be comfortable, but I could. It's like a large cooler versus a, you know, I don't know, gallon jug versus basically.
So
mine takes about 6 hours to do a similar sort of finish versus yours might take an hour or 30 minutes or something. But yeah.
Yeah. It's got the main factor with that is the weight of the media.
Yeah.
You got more media in there. It's putting more pressure on the material as it's tumbling or whatever. And that makes a lot of difference. So yeah,
for sure.
That definitely makes a difference.
Yeah.
But yeah, super pumped about that. So
sweet. All right. So you guys were also helpful this week in sending us a few knife stories, and I've got one and Jonathan's got one. I'm going to go ahead and read mine first, if that's all right.
Absolutely.
All right. So mine is from Matty G. That's what the email says. The email name. Hello there. My name is Matt Gonzalez, 32, Texas born and raised. My wife just got shipped out to the Air Force 8/19/25. We got married on July 10th this year as well. I've been collecting knives for a few years now, from Microtech to Chavez and ProTech, etc., etc. I've always wanted a McNeese ever since I saw your amazing work a few years back at Blade Show on YouTube. It's been forever my grail to have one, and when I saw the Dixon this past year at Blade Show, this past year, Blade Show Atlanta release, I was drooling. Well, as part of my wedding gift, my retired father got me, himself, and my brother a Dixon the moment DLT dropped them. When I got my knife, I was stunned. I couldn't believe that I had a box in my hand that said McNeese Knives. I was in a dream state, I thought. Sorry, my reading is bad. I forgive me. But when I opened it, I was like a child at a chocolate or candy store. I've never gotten such a wonderful gift when you consider the craftsmanship and hard work that goes into these flawless beauties. I will cherish this blade forever, and I'm taking it with me and my wife when we move in a few months when she gets stationed to a new place. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for making such perfect knives and tools. My next goal is to make it out to either Texas or Atlanta and meet you guys. That was it. So he said, keep up the good work, and thanks for making the best USA-made knives.
Well, that's awesome. Maddie going to make me blush over here. That's, that's cool. We appreciate that very much. Sounds like, did you say it was the father-in-law that bought the knives?
Let's see. His father.
Father, okay.
Yeah,
all right. I was going to say his father-in-law. I was going to say you married well if you got a father-in-law that's hooking you up like that. But obviously you got an awesome dad then instead. And so, yeah, that's fantastic. Very, very cool.
It's super cool getting one for himself and his brother and his dad, and they all sort of share them together now. So that's a cool thing.
Yeah, that's really, and to kind of, you know, commemorate a special occasion like that, that's always, you know, and I feel like knives are one of those kind of traditional gifts for things like that, that to commemorate.
Definitely.
You know, knives, watches, things like that are kind of traditional commemorative type gifts. So that is really cool from my end to get to hear that. So thank you.
Yep.
Very cool. All right. So we had another one that we got through a comment that I'm going to read off here, and that is by Mr. Rob's Nerdy Knives. All right. So Rob goes on to say, well, back when I just started to collect knives after my first big purchase of a $100 Benchmade Cabela's Orange Mini Barrage knife, I was invited to my wife's office party. They all knew I was a knife guy. They needed a bottle of wine open that had a thick aluminum seal on the spout cork. Uh-oh, see where this is going. They asked me to open it since I had a knife, not realizing that I was carrying a nicer knife. It was a TRM Atom in tie scales, or maybe a Mac 2. He doesn't remember for sure. I ended up cutting off the seal made of aluminum because I only had my one knife. And yes, I rolled / scratched that edge. I learned then why I always need to carry a small fixie or slip joint with me when I carry a nicer knife. As a result, I carry more than one knife to every party, and I'm asked to sharpen the chef knives of my wife's boss when he grills the very fancy meats at these parties. So, yeah, I think we've mentioned that before. You talked about, like, loaning your knife to somebody and asking them what they're going to use it for beforehand or whatever, but I can see the spot he was in. You know, he got called on to be the knife guy, and he couldn't, you know, oh, no, I'm not going to cut the aluminum seal. So, yeah.
Sometimes you got to just do it.
That's kind of a bad spot to be in, but probably was a pretty easy fix, I would imagine, with touching it up, sharpening it. So that's,
yeah.
I think we've probably all been in a situation where either we did something like that or we loaned it to somebody and they did something like that. So that's, we can definitely relate, Rob. Yep. So awesome. We appreciate those stories, guys. Please keep them coming. Like, we're going, I mean, I would love it actually if this is kind of like an ongoing segment where we had stories submitted by you guys, you know, about just kind of anything knife related. You know, let's not be, you know, admitting to any crimes or anything like that, but that's anything short of that, bring them on. So
for sure.
Very cool. Very, very cool. So I had seen a discussion, or at least I saw a question or two posed this week. Captain Ricky Hernandez, that works with Best Damn EDC. I saw him posting his story, a couple of questions, and they were basically kind of trying to get down to what people considered custom versus production. You know, I don't think mid-tech was in the discussion, but that always ends up falling into the discussion there. So thought that was a topic that's been talked about a ton, but also a topic that always seems to come back up. So
yeah,
thought that might be something interesting for us to discuss.
For sure. And interestingly enough, we also had a question from Ian Humphrey, who's asked a question before, but he said, when do you go from being a custom maker to a mid-tech or to a full production? I always thought that as soon as you use a CNC machine, you are no longer considered a custom maker. But what if you only use it to machine and make parts and everything else is done by hand, et cetera. So yeah, he was very much sort of thinking along that same line this week.
Yep.
And I guess that's like you said, that question seems to be cyclical. It comes back around every few years and the question is always the same, or the answer is basically always the same. You know, we don't know.
Yeah.
But we are going to talk about it for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of, honestly, unfortunately there's not agreed upon, you know, actual right or wrong decision, or you know,
knife making's not one of those professions like welding or something that has like a, you know, or an electrician where, you know, you have like a journeyman or a master electrician. You don't have like a, I mean, I guess we do have a guild, but it's not necessarily
for certain
applicable for the entire thing. Not everybody's a part of the guild or whatever. So,
nor does everybody agree with some of their definition of terms and stuff either, which I know in years long gone by actually caused quite a bit of stir with the guild and people to be either kicked out or not allowed in and so on and so forth, but how the different methods they were using. So,
yeah. And that was from, you know, back in the, just using water jet days to people getting CNCs. And now, you know, I think it's now just, basically they say you have to, it used to be you had to at least hand grind the blade 5-6 years ago. Now it's, I think you have to grind the blade in your shop. And so Les George recently got a like burger type machine, a big CNC grinder type machine.
Yeah.
And he made a joke basically saying like, you know, according to the guild, he makes, you know, these are all custom knives because he makes them in, you know, they're all ground in his shop.
By their definition, he's grinding them in his shop. So
yeah. So it's,
he's got the technology to do it. And that would apply to us now as well, you know, because we've got using a different type of method to do it, but still being ground in our shop. So
yeah, there's really no good way to define it because I mean, I don't think you would try to claim that they're actually custom knives. And I don't think Les would try to claim that the ones coming off his machine are actually custom knives. I mean, he does make custom knives as well, or he used to. I don't know if he still does, but
yeah, I think he still has some that he classifies as custom. So we should probably kind of back up a little bit and try to. So, first let's try to kind of try to cover the middle ground, the mid tech definition first, or whatever. So. Honestly, I think it's kind of a outdated term that probably just needs to go away at this point, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Because all it does is confuse people. I actually hear people refer to our stuff as mid-tech a good bit, but that doesn't, by the definition that I understand of it, it's definitely not accurate to what we do. My understanding, and I correct me if I'm wrong, but I know for a fact that Ken Onion coined the term, and my understanding is that he was at the time he was getting some parts made, you know, basically OEM work done. And I don't know to what extent they were being done. Like, I don't know if the blades were being ground and everything else. And he was just doing like the hand fit up stuff. I don't even know what level that was at the time.
From my understanding, the first mid-techs was he had a mini mill in his shop. He had water jet parts cut, put them on his mini mill, had the profiles and cut out. And I think he did chamfers or whatever. And, you know, obviously did holes and counterbores, but the blades were all still hand ground and hand rubbed even.
Yeah.
And he was calling those mid-techs.
Yeah. Which by today's standards would very much be a custom.
Yeah.
In my mind. Well, in that, well, we'll get into that discussion next. custom versus whatever. But so, yeah, that definition has definitely changed a lot based off. And, I mean, I think it all started just with basically Ken trying to be transparent and about the fact that he was having some parts water jet cut or whatever, that something was being done outside of his shop, you know, versus the good old, you know, cutting them out with a bandsaw or whatever, which is what pretty much everybody did at the time that, you know, made handmade stuff. So, and we'll touch back on the transparency thing in a minute, but that, I think that's 100% where it came from. And then I think it kind of crept into people having more and more stuff done, even to the point where, you know, I did a small run of like 50 knives before we started the actual, what I call the production version. I did that small run of 50, the PM1s, and they were all of the, I got the parts fully machined. The bevels were not ground on the blade. So it was blade blanks that were, I mean, they were fully milled as far as the profile, had all the holes in them and all that, but they were not ground. The bevels were not ground. And so I fit locks, I fit detents, I ground the blades and did all the finish work on them. And made clips for them. I think the clips were water jet cut.
They were.
Yeah, cleaned them up and bent them. So that was what I, at the time, I considered that to be mid-tech. You know, now I think people just kind of, OEM is kind of, which is probably really the truer definition of it anyway. I think, you know, OEM and mid-tech are almost kind of interchangeable. And it just, you know, but it's also very vague because one person may OEM two or three of the processes. Another person may OEM, you know, 90% of the processes. So
yeah,
they're and not necessarily all OEM equal.
Some may not even be getting, you know, a knife in their hand. You know, they may just be getting the company to produce a, you know, knife for them.
Yep. And that's, I would consider that, like, in most industries, I think that would be like, if somebody else is creating a finished product for you, I think that would fall under what's tip and it, but putting it under your brand, that's typically what's referred to as private label, which means that, you know, and there's lots of companies and lots of industries that do this. You know, they have the capacity to make said product, more capacity than they have to sell their own product. So they make product for other people and label it as, you know, as the whoever they're making it for. So technically that probably would be a better description of it, would be like private label or somebody that's basically having a turnkey product made for them, you know, under their branding. That would, that's what I would call it. I know it's not common in our industry to that term is not, but that's technically what it is.
Yeah, that's definitely what it is. And, you know, it's all about what, you know, chasing that percentage. What is the acceptable percentage of, okay, I did X amount of work on it, you know, versus I, you know, didn't do any work on it. You know, it's all, and it, to a certain extent, I think it's person to person, depends on, you know, who you ask.
Well, this is probably a good time to interject this, like what I said a minute ago about the transparency, because I don't think there's necessarily any right or wrong.
No.
It's just a matter of being transparent about your process so that people know what they're buying. You know, like I'm not going to judge somebody for, you know, having parts this much done or whatever, as long as they're being honest about it. Now, do I think that people ought to be having their crap made in China? No, I do not. I'll be honest, I do judge you for that. So it is what it is. but short of that, you know, if you can make, and do I think, to me personally, do I think it's more cool if you can, you know, can make the product yourself, or at the very least have the ability to make the product yourself? Now, like if somebody like say you're over there cranking out handmade knives all day, right? And then you found an OEM shop, or let's call it private label. You found somebody that could do you a turnkey product in the, you know, in the U.S. or whatever, and you wanted to have that as like a separate line in your knives. And they, you know, you clearly stated that that's what it was, that these are, you know, these are my private label line or my whatever. And you're honest with everybody about it, then I don't see any problem with that. You know,
I think it's
more cool if somebody at least has the ability to do it versus just, you know, coming up with a drawing and taking it from that. But even that is not, I'm not saying it's wrong. I just think it's more cool if you actually can do the full thing, but that's just me. I think that just comes from being the, you know, having the creative, you know, maker mindset or whatever. But, but transparency is the key, and honesty, telling people what you're doing, you know. And then let's remember to come back to pricing towards the end of this discussion. I don't want to get us too far off the rails here. So that, again, to me, mid-tech basically is kind of an outdated term. I think it's just a matter of, you know, letting people know what percentage of the work that you're actually doing and what percentage of it you're farming out, more or less, just being transparent with your process. That, you got anything more to that?
No, I definitely agree. I mean, I don't, you know, as much as we think it's an outdated term and, you know, probably should go away, it's probably never going to go away. We, for a long time, we needed sort of a term for what was in the middle between a handmade knife and a, you know, full on production knife. And Ken just happened to be the one to coin the term, and its original meaning is basically lost at this point.
Yep.
In terms of real world applicability, but I think it is always going to stand as sort of that mid ground between, and you know, it's sort of in the name, mid tech. But you know, that middle ground between full on handmade and, you know, K bar or something like that.
Right.
So in that term, I could see, you know, your company being described as a mid tech. I don't know what K bar puts out, but I'm guessing it's a lot. And
right.
I know what I put out, and it's not a lot. And I know you put out somewhere in the middle. So,
yeah,
you know.
And see, I feel like it should be defined more by, not by size, but by methods. You know what I mean? Like, because, you know, there's a big difference between, you know, even like between me doing what I was doing, like I said, with that, with what I call the mid-tech run, where I had all the machining stuff done, like, you know, call it a, it definitely wasn't the level of private label, because it was not a turnkey product that I just got and all I had to do was sell it and ship it. I had to do actually a lot of the most critical parts of it myself, to include grinding the blades. So I would call it, you know, OEM, you know, knives made with OEM work thrown in there, whatever, like mid-tech, whatever you want to call it. But there's a big difference in that. And if I did that, you know, all year long, that I still don't necessarily feel like that's a production company. If I'm sitting there by myself in my shop, you know, taking OEM parts and doing all the other stuff to them and putting them together, I don't really feel like that qualifies as a production company. However, what we do now is, you know, me and several employees, I mean, there's a good bit of stuff. There's nothing that I do exclusively myself on every knife that comes out of the shop. Like, I pitch in and I help on different things, but there's nothing that I can say that I do this process on every knife that comes out of the shop. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's been knives that came out of the shop that I probably never even touched, other than maybe inspecting them or whatever. So it just all depends on the day to day, you know, where I'm needed to jump in and help, or how things are going or whatever. So, that definitely is not, you know, I would not consider that mid-tech, because you don't have a singular maker. You know, I could even stretch it so far as to maybe think like a maker, kind of like almost like what we were doing in the beginning was probably closer to being mid-tech, where, you know, we were doing essentially that same process, except we were having the blades ground by the OEM shop. And so then it was literally just fitting up locks, fitting up detents. And in the early days, though, we were, just because I was not smart enough to actually have stuff smart enough, or couldn't afford to have stuff made to our specs as far as hardware and stuff. We were taking off the shelf hardware. We were modifying it to the correct length and all that ourselves to make it work. But it was, you know, me and you doing most of the handwork. At that point, I mean, it would kind of be hard to argue that that's a production shop.
Yeah.
But it's also not a one man handmade custom shop.
Yeah. And that's where the ambiguity, that's the word I was looking for, comes in for production. 'Cause I mean, you know, some people would look at that and be like, oh yeah, that's production. They're just, you know, out. It's not necessarily all in your shop, but, you know, we were making production-ish knives. And, like, you know, I don't know for a fact, but in some of these bigger production factories and stuff, you know, I don't know what percentage, you know, they're getting done in that shop, or if there's like an assembly facility, or, you know, if they're, what they're sending out to get ground or milled or cut or, you know, whatever else. And
there's
so,
definitely shops that are bigger than us that are still having blade grinding outsourced and stuff like that. So,
yeah,
you know, I know of at least one company that has, they have over 10 times the amount of employees that we have. And I know for a fact that they're still getting their blades ground out. And I'm not knocking it. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying, in this discussion of, what do you call it? You know, there are much bigger shops putting out way bigger volume of knives that are still having, you know, some of the processes outsourced. So you can't necessarily define it by that either, you know, you know, so it's kind of it's a very weird, in my mind, when it comes to the size thing, it's basically somewhere in that, you know, maybe I kind of almost feel like it's when you have, like, you know, like I said, having one person and a helper, or whatever, to me, that still kind of feels like in that mid-tech, you know, OEM range. When you get two or three people helping you, you know, then I feel like you've crossed over into production, albeit very small batch boutique kind of production. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then obviously, you know, where the line goes from there to being small batch boutique type stuff to being just full on production, like a Benchmade or a Case or, you know, whatever. I don't know exactly where that line would be, but somewhere, you know, I don't know if it would be a set number of knives, you know, you're putting out per year, per month, whatever, a set number of employees, you know, I don't know how you would quantify that, but I just, you know, when you look at it in the real world, I think it's easy to say. You can look at a shop like us, or even somebody that's considerably bigger than us, like Hinderer, or Emerson, or a couple of others, and they're putting out way more knives than we are and have way more employees than we are, but they still don't have employees nowhere near the size of like Case Knives or Benchmade or whatever. Like, you know what I mean? So yeah. It's kind of just in my mind, once you get to the point where, especially if you're to the point where, like I said, if I'm like the guy, the maker, and I'm doing a very small percentage of the work, or maybe sometimes there's, like I said, there's knives going out of here that I didn't even do really any of the work on, then it's definitely, in my mind, it is not right or fair to call that like a mid-tech or custom or whatever. Like that to me, you have definitely crossed over into the production world if that's what, if you have a team of people putting stuff together or, you know, doing all the work. So, and then it's just a matter of how big you are, you know,
For the record, I agree. I'm just saying that because of the disparity of the size between those, you know, three sort of entity types, that I think that the people in the middle that are doing production type stuff, but it's not the same as Case Knives production right. type stuff.
For sure.
I think we need a term for that, and that old term gets brought back and applied
yeah.
to it,
yeah.
you know, rightfully or wrongfully.
Yeah. As much as it doesn't sound like a term that would apply to you know, badass knives, but like in most industries, I feel like that would be kind of like a boutique type of setup or whatever. Like it's like we call ours technically small batch production, which is, you know, I don't have a better term. Maybe I need to coin a term and maybe it'll stick.
Yeah.
It's production, but it's not, you know, high volume production. But again, I don't even know off the top of my head what number you would have to cross to consider it high volume. You know, I mean, is it,
yeah,
you know, is that 5,000 knives a week? Is that 20,000 knives a week? You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Is that 1,000 knives a week? I mean, Lord, 1,000 knives a week is a lot of knives. I can just tell you guys right now, that's way more knives than we put out in a week, way more.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know. And I don't know honestly how many knives I don't know how many knives like Hinderer and Emerson and them guys put out. I don't know how many knives Benchmade puts out in a week, Case puts out in a week. So I don't know where the dividing line is, but somewhere in there, I feel like you cross over from small batch production to full on just big production.
Yeah.
You know, but it's the same thing. You have, I mean, in other industries or whatever, I mean, you think about it, you have businesses, whatever it may be, that have, say your local insurance people, you have an insurance office that employs, you know, one or two like insurance salespeople and a secretary. And then you have some that are like, you know, hundreds of employees. They're both insurance companies. Nobody would argue that. Like, you know, it's just a matter of how big they are, you know, and there's, I think in a lot of industries, there's not necessarily a need to define what the size is, but because we're making actual, you know, craftsmen, you know, it's different. We're making a physical product that's, you know, people want and should want to know how it's made, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. And so we've kind of trended more towards the production side, but on the, I guess, custom side of that question that Ian asked, he said, I always thought that as soon as you use a CNC, you are no longer considered a custom maker. And I definitely don't think that's the case these days.
Probably not the maker. Yeah, that's probably definitely not the most widely accepted definition by all means.
Again,
everybody has their own opinion, but
Maybe so, late 90s or, you know, sometime, you know, early 2000s even, that would probably have been the case. But there's definitely a ton of custom makers that, you know, either use their machine to help efficiency and, you know, just be able to make more knives, cut out some of the grunt work, or they use it to do things that they cannot do by hand.
Yeah.
People like Michael Birch is a very good example of that. He uses his machine to make insane little cutouts and cut out things that are, would be almost impossible to hold. You could probably find a way, but to be able to cut that out and hold it by hand, it would be very, very difficult. But he uses his machine in that way to do that. And then there's others like Kurt Merrickin of Merrickin Knives. Kinnison Knives use some CNC in their work, but they're definitely not a production company by any means. It's two guys, but they're still making custom handmade knives. You know, there's a bunch of those guys out there these days.
Yeah. I think by the most accepted definition, I don't think would exclude using a CNC as being a custom, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's, it basically has become another tool in the toolbox for people, you know. I mean,
for sure.
At one point people, you know, forged and or used files and stuff too and didn't have electric grinders to run off of or whatever, you know. I mean, it's evolved. Our technology has evolved to where I think that's, for the most part, has just become considered another tool in the craftsman's toolbox at this point. But I think you actually just said something that I've been meaning to say about this the whole time. So when you really get down the nitty gritty, and this is getting back to part of what Ricky's question was about that I saw posted. So you could really even get down to the nitty gritty of the difference between custom and handmade. All right. Because what most of us call custom these days is probably technically handmade, you know, or if you then, and well, let me explain that, because by a lot of people's definition and in a lot of the other industries and stuff's definition, a custom would be something that's made to a customer's specs, right? Yep. That I think at one point was kind of the accepted definition of a custom, would be that basically you took an order for, you know, whatever the customer specs, the handle material, the, you know, so on and so forth. But now custom and handmade have basically for a long time now have just been basically made interchangeable. And it's, you know, you can, like what you do and what I used to do for, you know, after the first couple of years or whatever, I decided I was done with, you know, having books or whatever and taking custom orders. For the most part, I basically made stuff, maker's choice, and then I sold it, you know, which is basically what you do now for the most part, right?
Yeah.
I think probably the truer definition of what that is handmade, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's not, because you're not technically, but at the same time, that it's become so interchangeable with custom in our world that it's kind of even a dumb argument to, you know, they're interchangeable. Like it's just, it is what it is. That's just how it's developed in our world.
Yeah.
But then you could get into the trap of, okay, well, if it's technically handmade, and this is where custom potentially is a better word for it, even though it doesn't fit the more pure definition of a custom, because then is it right to call somebody, those guys that you were just talking about, you know, all the makers out there that are making what we call customs that are using CNCs, would you call those handmade? You know, because that gets tricky too. Well, I mean, yes, in a way I could still see calling them handmade, but at the same time, they're handmade with the, you know, with the assist of a CNC.
Yeah.
So, and don't get me wrong, guys, I'm not knocking either one. I've done both. Like I, as having somebody that used to make stuff totally by hand without a CNC, and well, I've done nearly all the levels. I've done the totally by hand, cutting stuff out totally by hand. I've done having water jet parts cut and taking it, doing everything from that point by hand. And then, like I said, did the mid-tech kind of thing there for one run, and now doing small batch production. So like, other than like the large scale production, I've done all of that. And none of it's right or wrong. It's just a matter of what do you call it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think it could get a little misleading to some people, maybe, to call something that's done with where you do a fair amount of CNC work on it, to call that handmade. Which is why I think just calling them customs is probably a better term anyway. What do you think?
Yeah, but it does make it difficult for guys like me, because, you know, I'll have people send me something that, you know, somebody's done on a CNC, a cool pattern or an inlay, or you know, they'll be like, yeah, can you just put an inlay in it? And I'm like, no, no, I can't. As a matter of fact, unless it's a circle, I can't do that. I don't have that capability. I don't have a machine to make that inner profile cut out and do that for me. I don't have a pantograph or anything like that either. That's a sort of old school manual way of doing it, like a lot of the slip joint guys do. But, you know, it does make it difficult for the fully handmade guys and the, you know, as far as expectations and, I guess, capabilities.
Yeah. For people that don't necessarily understand the differences in the methods that you're using, it kind of runs it all together.
And, yeah, because, you know, this guy's a custom and this guy's a custom. Well, why can't you do what he does and why can't he do what you do and, you know,
right,
all that sort of thing.
Right. And so, you know, there was another term that was coined. I have no idea who coined it. And honestly, well, there's only one reason that I don't like the term, and I'll tell you in a second. But the MAC, the machine assisted custom, you know, because I know it at Blade Show. Well, I don't know if they did this past year.
It's MACK at Blade Show, but yes. And it was, I think,
okay,
2 years ago.
Machine assisted custom knife.
Yeah.
So they basically came up with that term as far as like the awards stuff and all, whatever, to have a, so that it would kind of separate exactly what we're talking about. The guys that were doing customs without CNC and the guys that are doing customs with CNC. So it's kind of like a subcategory of customs, essentially. And the only reason I didn't like it is because the Mac in our designation, like the Mac 2, had nothing to do with that. That was just a play on my name. So,
yeah.
And then that coin that, somebody coined that term and came along, and now I'm like, it gets lumped in with that. And like I've already said, I do not consider ours machine at this point. I don't consider them machine assisted customs. I consider them small batch production. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that was just an unfortunate
timing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it was Jim at HMC Knives. Or HMC
that first came up with it.
Yeah, I think
it may have been. I think I saw it. Actually, may have been Jeremy Marsh. Don't want to take anything away from Jim or anybody else, but I think I saw Jeremy Marsh use that term.
Okay.
A while back too. Probably quite a while back, actually. But anyway, doesn't matter. Somebody coined that term, that phrase,
yeah.
And I don't see it used much, though. But honestly, the only time I've really seen it used is like the awards stuff at Blade Show, just to separate the subcategories.
I'm not even sure that it was
one of the categories this past couple of Blade Shows.
It was. I mean, I think they only introduced it two, three years ago. Yeah.
Oh, you know what? Probably because I was looking at the production categories and I wasn't paying attention to the custom categories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You done left us behind. You go play over there. Go play in your sandbox.
No. Well, so, okay, here we go. You got anything else? That brings up something else I want to mention, but have you got anything else on those kind of basic terms that get used the most?
Not really, but are you circling back around to pricing, or do I need to remind you to do that?
Yeah, you need to remind me about that. Let's do that first, and then I can talk about what I want to talk about, the other thing. So, yeah. So, my 2 cents on the pricing as far as all these different categories is, we've kind of said this before, not about these categories, but just in general about people pricing their work. Like, people can price their work at anything they want to price it at. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, typically people are going to price, you know, something that's more handmade higher than something that is less handmade, typically. That's kind of typically what the market expects, is for something that's, you know, And even something like, say you call it a mid-tech or whatever, like the, you know, where you got some OEM work done, but you're doing parts of the process. It's not a turnkey, you know, private label kind of thing, you would expect typically for the pricing on the OEM or the mid-tech knife to be more than the pricing of like a turnkey private label kind of knife and on yes. down the line, right? That being said, people can price their stuff at anything they want to. And like, it's not an insult. It's not a, like somebody has not wronged you because they price their mid-tech knife at what you think should be custom prices, or they price their, small batch production knife at what you think should be a mid-tech price or so on and so forth. Now, if you think it's priced too high for what it is, then don't buy it. You know, like absolutely. Like if it's more than what you're willing to pay for what that is and how it was made, then your right is absolutely to not support that and not buy it. But I see pretty frequently people just flat out getting mad. Like just this vitriol online about like just dogging, companies or makers out for their prices or whatever. And it's like, guys, like they have the right to price their product at whatever they want to. The market's going to tell them whether it was good or bad. You know what I mean? Like if just like you have the right to not buy it or to buy it if you agree or disagree with the price. Like, but there's no reason to be getting like mad at somebody. Well, he's charging so-and-so price for for a production knife or so-and-such in price for a mid-tech and that's custom prices or whatever. Well, I get it. Obviously you like the knife and you would like to buy it or else it being too much wouldn't be a problem for you. You know what I mean? Like I don't give a crap how much a Prius costs, cause I don't want one. I'm not going to get mad if they price a Prius at, $200,000 because I don't want it anyway. Price it whatever you want, dude. Like it's whatever. So I get it that if it's something you want and you'd like for it to be within reach, but you feel like the price is too high, sure, it might be frustrating, but the person has not wronged you. Like they're not needing to be chastised online because their price is higher than you think it should be. Like that's just very childish and immature to me to be like getting mad at people. And like, have you seen that? Is it just me?
Yeah, no, I've seen that. In that particularly, I've seen one Benchmade getting a lot of flack lately. It came out and it's $450 or something like that, and saw some people rather upset about it. But nothing related to me or any of my but like I've definitely seen people get mad about stuff like that before, and think that happens a lot more in the production side of the world.
It does. I think the production slash, I think it also, there's a fair amount of it in the, like that mid-tech, whatever kind of world. Cause people are like, like I said, mad because it's priced what they feel like a custom price should be, but yet, they feel like it's priced too high for what it is for the level of work the person selling the knife put into it themselves or whatever. But guys, you also don't know how much those people paid for that stuff, Now, the one instance where I can kind of agree with it, although I still wouldn't, just selfishly, it makes me giggle when you see the Chinese OEM stuff and people are bashing them because of their prices, because they're charging like USA-made prices or whatever for it. That always kind of makes me feel good. But even with that, like same thing applies. Like if you don't agree with the price, don't buy it. That will straighten it out. Like that's the market is going to dictate how much the knife is going to sell for. Like if it's priced too high and they don't sell, they'll either quit making them or they'll lower the price. Like,
yeah. I mean, that's how it got to this point. People kept buying them.
It works in inverse too. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you can sit here and say all day long that the knife's overpriced, but if enough people are buying them, that they're selling as many of them as they need to sell to be profitable, then it doesn't matter what you think or anybody else thinks because the market is telling them that it's fine because they're selling them. Yep. So,
that's like some of these sort of fancy production houses like Rockstead and William Henry and stuff that make like sort of fancy production knives that are rather expensive. I mean, they're very expensive, higher than a lot of makers' custom prices, including mine, and, you know, but they've been in business for a good while now. People are buying them. People like them. So,
right.
It is what it is.
Well, and just like we mentioned back in the episode talking about pricing and stuff, there's, like it or not, the brand, the name does have an effect on pricing, good or bad. If you don't have enough of a name built up and enough of a reputation built up, and it's not, you know, the people aren't wanting one so they can be in the cool kids club. And I'm not knocking that, because, like, I'm the same way. Like, I like, you know, there's stuff that I like that's popular that, you know, I'm sure part of the reason I like it is because it's popular. You know, I mean, that we're, most of us are wired that way as human beings. Like, nothing draws a crowd like a crowd. If a bunch of other people have it, I mean, it's, we've all seen it our entire lives. Like, it's why, you know, when you were in school, like when I was in school, and I'm going to date myself here. Like when I was in school, like, and I'll go ahead and say I never had one either, but we were too, I guess, too poor, or my parents had enough sense, I don't know, not to buy one, but like members only jackets were like the thing, you know. Like, mm-hmm. I was definitely one of the uncool kids, because I was not one of the ones that had a members only jacket. I had a you know, military field jacket instead. That was more my style. But and I thought it was the coolest thing in the world.
I can see that.
But yeah, but we've all, like, you know, we've all been a part of that one way or the other our entire lives. And like I said, some people kind of chase it more than others, and there's nothing wrong with it either way. Again, it's human nature. Like, we're pack animals, we're herd animals. So, like, if it's, you know, if other people like it, most of the time it makes it more appealing to us. And so you can get a certain amount of, you know, pricing that's based on reputation and name, whether it's reputation that's earned by the quality of the product. And usually it is. Usually if something becomes, now, at least in, I feel like in our world, you know, now some stuff, you know, maybe like in the fashion industry or stuff like that, it might not always equate to quality, but most of the time, most of these, like, iconic brands that demand really high prices because of their name, like Rolex, for example, like, mm-hmm. like, Rolexes are expensive, they're cool, but they're also good, high quality watches, you know, or at least they started out that way. And they probably still are. I honestly don't even know that much about watches or Rolex specifically, but I can pretty much guarantee you that they built their brand to the point that their name could command the kind of money that they command by building a quality product that was superior to most of the other stuff out there. And then over time, that equates with higher value, and they're able to charge more for their products because people see it as a perceived higher value. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes.
So, it's really easy to sit back and be like, oh, they're just buying it because of the name or whatever. Well, yeah, at this point that may be true, but like, how did that name get to be where it's at? You know, I think it happens sometimes just by really good marketing and hype buildup. That can for sure happen, but usually the ones that last, that their name, you know, they've been kind of iconic and been that way for a while, and they stay that way and therefore are able to charge higher prices, it's usually because it's built on a foundation of being better in the first place.
Yeah, and I agree. Even
if the industry around them has caught up to them some, you know what I mean? Like, so maybe Rolex is one of the very top, best quality to start with, and then other people have caught up to them and are doing similar quality, but they had already gotten such a head start with their name that now it's synonymous with quality, you know?
Yeah. But at the time, you know, people always forget the fact that, you know, we're not, you know, time didn't begin, you know, or like, well, time did begin, but point being, you know, at the point when Rolex started, they were chasing whoever the top dog was then in quality and price and, you know, did that thing. And then now whoever is, you know, Omega is chasing them. I don't know if Omega is actually chasing them. I don't know if Omega is even older than Rolex. So don't yell at me.
I get it. Yeah. But somebody is chasing them, trying to be the next Rolex or to outdo them or whatever. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So was that your tangent you were going on after pricing, or was there another point you were going to bring up on the custom production?
The other one wasn't really a tangent. It was honestly kind of more of a, I guess, a question. I'd actually really like to get some feedback on this from you guys. So, because I've been thinking more and more lately that I really want to get back to doing some version of like some custom stuff. And I know that most of the people that are in my position at this point, so say like, I know I bring up Hinder a lot, but like, it's just, it's a very good, you know, they're obviously considerably bigger than us and been around longer than us, but pretty good comparison as far as what they're doing and what we're trying to do. But guys like that and Emerson, like those guys still do custom knives, but from my observation, it seems like they're basically, it's essentially usually production models that are, that they've basically pulled parts for, and maybe they, instead of grinding the blade on the machine, they hand grind the blade, or they do some special touches to it or whatever, you know, maybe do some special stuff on the handles or whatever. Like, I may be wrong, but I don't think, at least some of the time for sure, that they're, you know, going in there with a bandsaw and starting totally from scratch and then calling that a custom. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I may be way off base. I may be wrong. That may be exactly what they're doing. But like,
yeah, but I doubt it. Cause I mean, like if I was to buy a Rick Hinderer custom or a Mick Strider custom or an Ernie Emerson custom, it's probably because I want a hand touched version of an XM18, of an SMG, of a, you know, Commander, you know.
Yeah.
It's because I you know, already want that, but I just want it a little bit more prestigious, basically.
Yeah.
So and, it would make sense to use the same sort of repeatability and methods, I think, to manufacture that.
I do. I feel like, and I would like to hear you guys' opinion on this, so please give me some comments on this. I feel like that the biggest distinguishing factor with that is the hand grinding of the blade. Like, I don't think most people could really care less if the handle, unless it's maybe on some models or whatever, or something specific, but like say on our knives, like I don't feel like people are going to necessarily care that much whether the handle was hand shaped or not. I feel like the blade grind is kind of like the heart of the whole thing. And that if, you know, if the blade is hand ground and the maker himself, you know, did the fit up and stuff, you know, fit the lock, fit the detent and stuff. Like that, that's kind of what I, the lines I'm thinking along of, like wanting to do some stuff like that. But I would really like to kind of, you know what people think about that, because, you know, for one, I want to be honest about what I'm putting out there. I don't want to call it a custom and then people think I'm over here at the bandsaw cutting out parts and shaping everything by hand and all that, when basically I grabbed a blade blank and some handles off the line, ground the blade and fit everything up, you know, and then I'm calling that a custom, but they think it's something else. You know, I, just like we said earlier, I want to be transparent. So, yeah. You know,
I mean, and sorry, go ahead.
No, that was pretty much it.
Okay. I mean, you know, there's other stuff that those guys do, like custom milling or cool inlays and stuff like that. Like,
right.
I've seen Mick Strider inlay, like, you know, some meteorite and some, like, you know, material from the Titanic or something like that. And,
right.
You know, do some interesting stuff like that that aren't necessarily productionable, if that's a word.
Yeah.
You know,
or kind of really, one-off stuff or a really small batch or.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I definitely think it would be something people would be interested in. But yeah, I'd like to hear what you guys have to say about that.
Yeah. And that's kind of the reason, you know, we had some, we sold quite a few, you know, when I sold them technically as production knives, but we sold several knives over the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years, that had hand ground blades, you know, and I don't plan on doing that anymore, because the next time I do that, it's probably going to be, you know, whatever label I decide to put on it, it's going to be more like a custom and stuff, and it's going to be priced accordingly. So, so if any of you got some of those, and honestly, those were done along the way because I had to, because like, it's what I had to do to save blades or to keep us moving or whatever. Like, we got in a tight spot and didn't have blades to use or something like that. So if anybody got those, then,
enjoy. You know,
yeah, probably that's probably not going to come around again at, you know, the little bit of upcharge that we charged for that before. It's probably going to be a whole different animal going forward. So
have you ever, I know you've talked to Rick a little bit here and there at Blade Show this past year and the year before. Did you ever ask him if he had to, you know, had any of those struggles. I'm assuming, you know, he did, just because these things seem to happen to everybody. But, like, you know, if there's any XM18s from 2007 that were hand ground because they got messed up or something and had to be fixed.
Right.
And,
no, I've never asked that, but that's a good question. I will going forward when I get to talk to some of these guys. That's a really good question. So
cool.
I would be curious to see if that's some of the same kind of stuff they did. And honestly, to clarify too, we had some that, and this comes out of me trying to have an abundance of honesty. Like, I just called them hand ground because I didn't know what else to call them, because we had quite a few blades that, like, when we were trying to figure out the whole blade, actually was when we were doing like the blade milling and stuff. And we were trying to do the hollow grinds on the mill with end mills, doing the step milling. The grinds would not be good. Like, they would have flaws in them and stuff like that we couldn't use. And so I would go in there and I would regrind them essentially by hand. And, you know, at that point it's a hand ground blade, but did I take a blank and start it from zero and hand grind it all the way up? No. So, like, you know, again, like, what do you label that as? So all of that just got lumped together under hand ground to us. You know, like, if I had to remove any significant amount of material, called it hand ground, you know. But like I said, that was a, you know,
part saving,
had to do it, like, you know, do what you got to do at the time. So I'll be curious to see what people say going forward about, and again, the label doesn't really matter. I just want to make sure I'm being honest and people know what they're getting when I offer it. You know what I mean? So,
for sure.
And I'll of course describe that. The problem is I can say it here on the podcast. I can say it in a post or whatever, but there's going to be people that end up with those knives in their hands, whether it's through the secondary or whatever, that never hear any of that. And all they see is whatever is being called, whether it be custom or hand ground or whatever, you know what I mean? So I probably worry too much, honestly, about trying to be as totally honest and transparent as we can. So,
probably so. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that you're probably going to have to repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat until sort of, you know, the world ends or something.
Yeah. And real quick, while we're on this subject, I know we're about to wrap it up here, but it's hilarious, dude, that I had the funniest thing happen this week. So, you know, I've been talking about how proud we were of the blade grinds and all that. And, you know, we struggled for almost the entire time that we've been doing this. Ever since I bought the first CNC, we've been trying to do step milling on the blades and make it work, right? And then we tried it for a while, never could keep it consistent enough, hence some of the hand ground stuff, like we said. Switched back to doing some of them CNC machine ground, you know, outsourced, and then some of them step milled on the machines, to now finding a completely different method to do it where we're getting really good clean hollow grinds, you know, grinding them on the CNC in-house.
Yeah.
But so, and I've been super proud of that. And I'm like, finally glad to be done with trying to mess with the step milling thing. And would you not know it, somebody posed a question this week. They're like, would you ever consider step milling the blades? And I'm like, oh my God. Are you kidding me? Like, we've been, no offense to this guy, like, it, but like, I was like, I have been struggling for freaking, you know, four years trying to make it work, and then putting them out there. And honestly, like, we had some people that liked the milling that we did on them, but it never was like something I felt like was just something people loved. And so finally come up with a solution that is what I feel like is way better. And then sure enough, somebody wants the other way. I will say the one caveat to that is, I think I didn't go into detail and ask him about it. I feel like he's probably talking about the horizontal step milling. And we always did, well, in the beginning, we actually did do some horizontal step milling. I didn't like it. I preferred having the step milling running vertically, so it looked more like grinds, you know, right off of the grinder or whatever. You could tell they were milled, but it more closely resembled hand grinds. And so I think he was probably referring to the horizontal step milling. And, you know, so it's not like it was a crazy question. It was just crazy to me because I'm like, we finally, like, getting going on some good grinds, and then somebody wants what we've been struggling with for the last 4 years that I've been trying so hard to get away from. So it's, you know, it's pretty funny.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always like that. As soon as you, you know, think you've found this great new solution, somebody's like, hey, can you do it the old way again?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can't.
Yep.
I can't do it.
Yeah. But anyway, but yeah, I answered his question. I told him, you know, that we'd had done it and we're away from it. But yes, so just so you guys, I have no plans of going back to step milling probably ever if, you know, if I can help it. So we'll see. Yeah. Things change. I could be doing it next month, but I don't plan to right now. So anyway. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that was a good discussion. I think that's always a topic we could talk about forever, and all the ins and outs of, you know, labels on stuff. So
we could probably
boils down to transparency and honesty, and the customer then bases their decisions on that, and everybody's good.
Yep.
So all right, well, we really appreciate it, guys. We'd love some feedback on all of this, but keep the questions and the stories coming. Let us know what you think. Please like, subscribe, all that good stuff. That helps us. We're 30 episodes in. We'd love to keep growing the show and be able to do more with it. So
for sure.
Appreciate
it. Thank you for guys for sticking with us for 30 episodes. Really appreciate all the support. And like you said, keep the questions and comments coming either on YouTube, or you can send them to knifefreakshow@gmail.com with one S. Find us on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, McNeeseKnives.com, BoatRideBladeWorks.wixsite.com. And yeah, we will. Wait, one more thing. Are you going to be out of town next week?
Good point. Yes. So we may probably going to be skipping a week, guys. We'll see. I'll coordinate it with Chase and see if we can, we might be able to make it work, but most likely I'm going to be out of pocket next week. So there's a more than likely we won't record next week. So sorry all about right. that.
Yeah, sorry. Didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I just remembered it. And if I didn't say it now, I wouldn't get said.
Good call. Yep, good call. We did need to say that.
Yep.
We appreciate you guys.
And let your freak flag fly.